they're trying to figure out what the consequences of wide-scale dispersant use are. And as far as the Arctic goes, I think that that question is still very open.
The potential toll of oil dispersants in Arctic waters. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, December 12th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, what the push for more LNG exports could mean for Alaska.
Yeah, there could be enough of a market for Lower 48 and Alaskan LNG.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking rope, chain, and boat anchors from 5 to 3,000 pounds on the web at arcticwirerope.com. Enroll now and get a career in less than a year in refrigeration, marine oiler, heavy equipment, or welding. Additional training programs and course information online at avtech.edu. Classes in Seward and Anchorage start in January. This message sponsored by Avtech.
The U.S. Attorney's Office in Anchorage today announced an indictment by a federal grand jury for wire fraud and false statements to the U.S. Department of Agriculture. The indictment is in connection with the construction and management of Valley Dairy, doing business as Matanuska Creamery in Alaska. The six-count indictment named 48-year-old Kyle E. Bues as the sole defendant. Bues is a co-owner of the dairy. U.S. Attorney Kevin Feldes says the allegations in the indictment charge that as early as 2007, Bues was involved in a scheme to defraud the USDA through federal grants.
It's alleged in the indictment that he submitted false invoices in order to obtain a payment for things that he didn't really purchase or spend the money on. In total, it's alleged that over $120,000 was fraudulently obtained.
The total amount of the USDA grants was $643,000. The Matanuska Creamery is located off the Palmer-Wasilla Highway. They sell wholesale and retail dairy products through a storefront at the creamery, which has been open for about 4 years. Feldes says the USDA's Office of Inspector General worked closely with the FBI to put the case together. The maximum penalties are up to 30 years in prison and $1 million in fines. A trial will be set for U.S. federal court in Anchorage within 70 days. A call to the owners of Matanuska Creamery was not returned before deadline. The Deepwater Horizon blowout of 2010 marked the first time that chemical dispersants were injected into an oil spill underwater. Now, a report from government scientists finds remarkably few ill effects from these chemicals. That has heightened concerns of several native groups and others who have been pushing for tighter regulation of dispersants. APRN's Steve Heimel reports that there are still many unanswered questions about what dispersants might do in Arctic waters.
The lead author of the government report, Dr. Jane Lubchenco, the head of the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, was a key advisor to Environmental Protection Agency head Lisa Jackson when she made the decision shortly after the blowout to allow them to use dispersants underwater.
And it was our judgment that use of dispersants would help the oil be naturally biodegraded more rapidly, and that certainly seems to have been the case.
Nearly 2 million gallons of dispersants, mostly Corexit, were used on the spill, close to half of it underwater, while the oil and gas was gushing out of the wellhead and broken pipe a mile deep in the waters of the Gulf of Mexico. The result was a sort of undersea fog of droplets of oil mixed with Corexit. Then, just months later, scientists couldn't find the fog, and there's some evidence that oil-eating microorganisms ate it. Depending on which scientist you talk to, it's either gone or it made its way to the bottom and is still percolating through the food chain. The report admits, we just don't know yet. But what if a spill happened in cold Arctic waters? Would dispersants do the same thing? That's a question everybody wants the answer to. The industry has just begun research to try to get answers. Cheryl Rosa is deputy director of the Arctic Research Commission, which recently issued a set of recommendations for what needs to be done to improve Arctic oil spill response capability.
The amount of dispersant that was applied in Deepwater Horizon was unprecedented. I mean, it was basically the world supply, from what I understand. And we need to be extremely well informed. with respect to the Arctic about how that's going to work. If they get applied, what the toxicity issues are, what the community concerns should be, and hopefully this new research will start to get at some of those questions.
Jane Lubchenco and the co-authors of the Deepwater Horizon Science Report talk about a public perception problem about the safety of seafood from the Gulf of Mexico. The government had a series of fisheries closures near the spill site and within a year reopened all the fisheries. Lubchenco says the evidence for contamination just never showed up.
We did learn a lot about that and discovered that, in fact, the fishes in particular, we were not able to find levels of dispersants in them after they had been, you know, swimming around in the ocean for a while.
She was quick to add that shellfish would not metabolize the chemicals as fast as finfish. And she went on to say that any adverse effects that might have been found from dispersants would not have been included in her report because such damages are still the subject of litigation.
Our papers don't talk about consequences of dispersants because we don't know that yet, and the information that might be in hand may be part of the legal proceedings.
There is evidence on the record that oil mixed with dispersants can be more toxic than oil on its own, particularly to larvae of marine life. And along the northern shores of Alaska, with their biologically rich lagoons, Cheryl Rosa says the questions about what such mixes could do are critically in need of answers.
Basically, dispersants get applied, drive oil into the water column where it is broken down into organic parts and pieces. They're trying to figure out what the consequences of wide-scale dispersant use are. And that's a work in progress as far as I can tell. And as far as the Arctic goes, yeah, I think that question is still very open and something that's in need of research.
In August of this year, Earth Justice and other environmental organizations sued EPA to force tighter regulation of dispersants. Then last month, a number of scientists and doctors joined several Alaska Native organizations in petitioning the EPA to ban Corexit or any other dispersant of undisclosed composition. In Anchorage, I'm Steve Heimel.
There's buzz in Washington that a recent report commissioned by the Department of Energy could speed up approval of export terminals for liquefied natural gas in the lower 48. As APRN's Peter Granitz reports, some energy experts say the effect will be minimal on Alaska, but that doesn't mean there isn't a market for Alaska's gas.
The report says that overall, exporting LNG will result in a net benefit for the economy. The country has a glut of natural gas, a supply that Deloitte's Tom Choi says we underestimate. That supply could help meet the growing global demand.
Yeah, there could be enough of a market for lower 48 and Alaskan LNG.
Some advocates for exporting LNG hope the Department of Energy will take the report's findings into consideration when it weighs the pending 15 permit applications. Choi says the Department of Energy's delays could hurt the chances of U.S. LNG making it to foreign markets because Australia is developing its own pipeline.
Well, I think part of it depends on what the DOE does. If DOE delays further, then it makes Australia more attractive.
More attractive to Asian markets in Japan, Korea, and India. The same markets Alaska producers might eventually sell to if producers on the North Slope opt to plunk down the tens of billions of dollars required to build a pipeline. Charles Ebinger from the Brookings Institution says the state should skip the pipeline and build an export terminal in Prudhoe Bay.
A very reasonable question would be, has anybody seriously looked at an LNG project's cost in comparison to the pipeline route down the Tidewater? Because I think it would be cheaper.
Ebinger says a terminal off the North Slope would take significantly less time to build than a pipeline, meaning the gas could get to market sooner. Governor Sean Parnell has offered more than $350 million for a liquefaction plant on the North Slope. In Washington, D.C., I'm Peter Granitz.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a new clue, a missing piece of map, re-energizes a missing person search.
That was torn right out of the map, right out of the center of the map. And that section was a new area that has not yet been searched.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by First National Bank Alaska, helping Alaska's dreams grow since 1922. On the web at fnbalaska.com, an equal housing lender, member FDIC. And by the Federal Aviation Administration, setting standards for the operation of aircraft and airports. FAA.gov/go/flyalaska or toll free at 1-866-357-4704.
You can add the name of NOAA Administrator Jane Lubchenco to the list of top Obama administration officials not sticking around for the president's second term. The Commerce Undersecretary for Oceans and Atmosphere told her staff today that she'll be leaving her job early next year.
I announced to the NOAA family today that I will be leaving at the end of February. So I'm really proud of all that we've been able to accomplish and know that I can leave knowing things are in good hands because there's a lot more to be done.
Lubchenco helped lead the administration's response to the Deepwater Horizon spill in the Gulf of Mexico and is responsible for fishery policies and marine mammal management, as well as the National Weather Service. NOAA's support for expanding quota share programs for allocating fisheries has been controversial in Alaska. Lubchenco is a longtime advocate for science and science communication to the public. A state commission is taking issue with the number of public hearings scheduled by the National Park Service on proposed regulations that would block some state sport hunts for bears, wolves, and coyotes in several national preserves. Citizens Advisory Commission on Federal Areas Executive Director Stan Liepart says single-site hearings like the one scheduled for tonight at Denali's Muri Science Center don't provide adequate opportunity for public input in affected rural communities.
You have three resident zone communities on the west side of the park that aren't really conveniently located in proximity to that meeting area. So it's going to be real difficult for folks in those communities to participate in this. And people are much more likely to go to a public meeting and express their concerns than they are to sit down and write a letter.
Liepart says the public hearing access situation is similar for hunters who live outside other affected preserves, including Yukon Charlie, Gates of the Arctic, Wrangell St. Elias, Lake Clark, and three in western Alaska. The Park Service has proposed continued or new bans on state game board approved hunts, including bear baiting in the preserves. Liepart voiced his concern about the hearings and the broader issue of the Park Service overriding state hunting regulations in a letter to the National Park Service Regional Supervisor. NPS spokesman John Quinley says the public has plenty of opportunity to weigh in on the proposals.
These public hearings are the first step in a process that may lead to the implementation of restrictions in what we call the annual superintendent's compendium. So people have an opportunity to comment both at these meetings, online, in writing, and then on whatever the final package includes.
Quinley says input from public hearings will be used to draft specific language banning the state hunts on preserve lands that will be included in the compendium, which is scheduled to be released in mid-January. Liepart says it would be better if public hearings were also held after the actual regulation language comes out. A number of Southeast leaders are upset about the governor's plan to scale back the Alaska-class ferry project. He made his announcement Tuesday in Ketchikan. Legislators and members of an advisory board say they should have been consulted first. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports.
You can tell a project's in trouble when its website gets pulled off the net. That's what happened to the Alaska-class ferry, which had a site including design elements, public comments, and other information. It's down because Governor Sean Parnell ordered an end to work on the 350-foot vessel and begin design of smaller, less expensive ferries. The announcement surprised Senator Dennis Egan, a Juneau Democrat who was among those pushing to fund the original project.
We're all upset that we weren't informed way early in this process about what they were going to do and different scenarios that they were trying to come up with. I mean, we didn't have a clue.
And it's not just the timing. Representative Beth Kurtula, another Juneau Democrat, says the new plan doesn't make sense.
This is a real change of direction, and frankly, I'm not on board, and I'm kind of talking to the other members of the Southeast delegation and doubt many of them, if any, are either.
The governor said change was needed because price estimates rose by up to 40%. Ferry officials had warned the approximately $120 million was not enough.
The new contemplated design is more of a streamlined, simple vessel.
Captain Mike Neusel is the State Transportation Department's Deputy Commissioner for Marine Operations. That means he runs the ferry system.
The cost savings will come in the simplicity of no crew quarters, smaller overall vessel, and less amenities in terms of what the vessel contains.
Other design elements, such as food service and quiet rooms for the sick and elderly, are also off the table. Some of those features were meant to allow the ship more flexibility so it could service more routes. Many of the state's vessels are old, and the Alaska-class ferry was part of the replacement plan. Curtula worries changing direction will push back the construction date.
This really delays us, right? And that's maybe more than anything something that aggravates me. You know, we've been working hard, we were up and running, it was going on, and now here we are with a delay.
The governor called for building two smaller ships with the money appropriated for the one larger vessel. Both would operate in Lynn Canal, connecting Haines, Skagway, and Juneau. That's the same route as was planned for the larger ship. The chairman of Parnell's Marine Transportation Advisory Board says the announcement caught him by surprise, too. Robert Venables of Haines calls it, quote, a very disappointing and dramatic change of direction. He's traveling and couldn't be reached by phone, but via email, he said the last board meeting, about a month ago, included no hint of a redesign. One reason Parnell gave for the change is to make sure new ferries are built at the Ketchikan shipyard.
That was just wonderful to hear his recommitment to build the ferries here in the state.
Alaska Ship and Dry Docks' Doug Ward says about 170 people work at the facility. He expects other shipbuilding jobs, so any ferry construction delays won't affect the workforce.
It's a state-owned shipyard. These are state-owned vessels. These are Alaskans building the vessels. And that was one of the primary goals, to create new employment opportunities in year-round family wage careers and to attract new investment.
Further discussion of the new plan will take place once the legislative session begins and the Ferry Advisory Board holds its next meeting. This is Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips. The easy oil is gone, and getting to the remaining oil will be a challenge that will require the state and the industry to work together. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
When you've made the decision to stop smoking, whether you've tried to quit before or it's the very first time, there are free and confidential resources available proven successful in helping you quit for good. Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line offers nicotine replacement therapy, confidential counseling, and support services. Because everyone is different, trained quit coaches will tailor a quit plan just for you. For more information, call 1-800-QUIT-NOW or visit alaskaquitline.com.
Teenage years are filled with change, and navigating relationships among peers is a big part of everyday life. Bullying and violence are just some of the pressures they face. In Sitka, a group of teens is pushing back against this norm by practicing open and honest communication, KCAW's Ann Bryce reports.
This is a video by the Sitka Youth Leadership Committee, or SILC.
The time that I felt like I didn't belong was when I felt left out by my peers whom I had full faith and trust in.
It felt like I just didn't want to be around those type of people, and made me feel worthless.
The group is made up of about a dozen high school students from Mount Edgecombe and Sitka High. They're describing how it feels to be without a sense of belonging.
I felt like I was in darkness. I was silenced, I was alone, I was not accepted, I was not cool enough, and I was left outside the circle of my peers.
Feelings get hurt and people talk a lot. There's a lot of gossip, things like that.
Katie Davis is a member of SILC. She's 16 and goes to Sitka High, where she says direct communication strengthened her personal relationships.
My friends were upset with me because I chose to hang out with other people on Halloween, I felt as if they just, like, shut me out, and then I was sad, and I learned that it wasn't going to get any better unless I said something about it. Once we finally communicated face-to-face instead of talking to other people and having it come around back to us, it was resolved, like, right then and there.
14% of high school students reported having been bullied 2 or more times a month. By using straightforward honesty, the committee hopes to create a community where people feel safe to express their emotions and inspired to work together. Julia Smith is a prevention coordinator at the local shelter, Sitkins Against Family Violence, or SAFE. She's working with members of SILC to replace violence with respect and compassion. She says it starts by asking some tough questions.
What are the societal factors that are contributing to this culture of violence, you know, that is either encouraging it to happen, or what are those factors that inhibit it from happening, and how can we build upon those factors that are creating a culture of respect and a culture where violence is outside the norm?
Smith says we live in a culture of dominance where louder voices often get more attention.
We all have different rhythms and different styles of communicating, so how do we create a space where the more introverted personalities feel like they have the time and the space to speak and that they will be heard?
I'm constantly reminding people, you know, have you ever been made fun of? And they always say yes.
Veronica Nelson is a student at Sitka's alternative school, Pacific High. She says bullying is a part of life that needs to stop.
Someone has always been made fun of, no matter what, whether it was once in their life or 20 times a day or whatever, someone's always been made fun of.
Nelson is in a leadership group at school. And like the youth in SILC, she's learned that by combining everyone's unique strengths, the outcome is that much more powerful.
I think everyone has a bit of a leader in them, in one way or another, whether it's being quiet when you need to be quiet. Sometimes I can't shut up. And then it's, you know, speaking up when you need to speak up. Some people can't speak up. So everyone has a piece of a leader in them. It's just a matter of bringing all of those together and making this giant group of leaders.
In 2011, the State of Alaska Department of Behavioral Health awarded a grant to Sitka's Primary Prevention Coalition. It's called Pathways to a Safer Sitka, and it will receive $200,000 every year over a 4-year period. Youth leadership groups are an example of primary prevention programs which aim to stop violence before it ever starts. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Ann Bryce.
Even the recent snow wasn't enough to stop the cancellation of the Sheep Mountain 150, a favorite mid-distance race in South Central. KUAC's Emily Schwing reports.
The 150-mile sled dog race was due to start from the Sheep Mountain Lodge 65 miles east of Palmer. Race director and veteran Yukon Quest and Iditarod musher Zach Steer says there's just not enough snow.
And a lot of the trail that we use for the race goes through some river valleys. And right now, they are just flooded wall-to-wall with ice and glaciation. And so without the snow cover to protect the dogs and the teams, it would really be a dangerous situation.
60 teams were signed up to leave from the start line this coming Saturday. Steer says the waiting list was also close to full. He says the race has grown in popularity since it began in 2004.
This time of the year, to me, it's not that important to be racing. I think, and I think a lot of the mushers have always appreciated that, and that's why the race was so popular. They come here to test their dogs, test their skills, see if their training's working out. The rookies come here just to sort of work out the jitters. Maybe some of them, it's their very first race ever. And so I've always tried to keep it a little bit low-key and more fun.
Lack of snow forced the cancellation of the Sheep Mountain 150 in 2007 and 2009 as well. Steer says he'll consider rescheduling the race for later in March or April. It's not the only race that has succumbed to a lack of snow this winter. Last month, the Two Rivers Dog Mushers Association canceled their annual tune-up, an early season warm-up over Thanksgiving weekend. In Fairbanks, I'm Emily Schwing.
Friends of missing wilderness survival instructor Tomas Siebold haven't given up hope of finding him. The search for the 31-year-old German outdoorsman officially ended in November, but those who know him say there's reason to resume looking. KUAC's Dan Bross reports.
Tomas Siebold was staying at a friend's cabin on the Upper Ambler River in the Brooks Range this fall when he disappeared. An October 7th entry in Siebold's diary found at the cabin indicates he headed out backpacking. Tamarack Song, who directs the Wisconsin-based Teaching Drum Outdoor School where Siebold works, says something else recovered from the cabin has yielded a clue to where he might be.
We found a map that had a missing
section on it that was torn right out of the map, right out of the center of the map. And that section was a new area that has not yet been searched.
A sprawling aerial search for Siebold was called off by Alaska State Troopers last month after finding no sign of him. Trooper spokeswoman Megan Peters says she understands how his family and friends feel, but there's no reason to resume the effort now.
They're looking at something and saying, well, this piece of the map or this map is not in the pile, so he must be in this area or he might be in this area. Can you go back and look? We, for one, think we looked in that area already. There's nothing that tells us that he actually is in that area. It's a hunch.
Peter says the search went on longer than normal because of Siebold's extensive outdoor survival training and experience. Song says he's carrying two winter sleeping bags, adding it's possible to survive for extended periods in winter with minimal gear. He notes the story of two people who lasted 49 days injured in the wilderness near Watson Lake, Yukon, after their plane crashed in early February 1963. The only possible sign of Siebold is a 14-foot diameter circle drawn in gravel along the upper Ambler River. Song says no one's sure what it means, but the area around it warrants another look.
All that was done so far with the ground search around the circle is about a 20-minute effort around the immediate area of the circle.
A recovery fund's been set up by Siebold's family and friends. Song says one possibility is paying locals to search. Kotzebue-based author and outdoorsman Seth Kantner considered the idea, but says the remote area where Siebold is missing isn't easily accessed.
Local people have been cut off from helping in this search because of the lack of snow. And then the upper Ambler River is braided in open water and sinkholes and dangerous. And I don't know anybody that has ever snowmobiled up there that far, you know, where the main search was taking place.
Kantner suspects Siebold died in a river accident or a fall, and he does not want to see others endangered by going out in sketchy conditions to look for him. Song acknowledges that darkness and extreme cold limit flying this time of year, and new snow will likely cover any signs of Siebold. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Dacia Eaton in Anchorage, Dan Bross and Emily Schwing in Fairbanks, Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, and Ann Bryce in Sitka. APRN's Peter Granitz reported from Washington, D.C., and Steve Heimel from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Pat Yak is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Older Persons Action Group, promoting well-being for Alaska seniors and their families, including publication of the monthly Senior Voice newspaper. Membership information at 1-800-478-1059. Bristol Bay Native Corporation, generations of jobs, heritage, and history. Bristol Bay, a place that's always been. Online at bbnc.net. And by BP, supporting public broadcasting in Alaska.
Increasing energy efficiency is an easy way to reduce energy consumption and save money. The Alaska Housing Finance Corporation now offers financing to publicly owned facilities to make improvements to increase energy efficiency. Find out more about how their loan program works and if there are public buildings in your community that are a good fit for the Alaska Energy Efficiency Revolving Loan Program at ahfc.us. This message sponsored by AHFC.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.